from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
First, I believe that the elections followed international standards for democratic elections. I was very impressed with the enthusiasm and the vigor in which people went to the polls to express their opinion.
That was Attorney Frank Abernathy from the United States speaking from Donetsk Sunday after the region's election results were posted. Former mining electrician Alexander Zakharchenko was the announced winner of the Donetsk elections with 765,340 votes, or 79% of the total of more than 1 million votes cast. Zakharchenko's party, the Donetsk Republic Party, also won the People's Council elections with some 662,000 votes. In Lugansk, the acting leader, Igor Plotnitsky, drew 63% of the vote. Turnout in the two regions exceeded 60%. The European Union and the U.S. have spoken out against the elections Sunday, claiming that they undermined the agreements reached in Minsk earlier this year. This was U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki responding to a question about the elections at her daily press conference Monday.
You made no secret of the fact that you weren't going to recognize these elections that were held in the East by the separatists. Not only did the secretary and the president say this, and the vice president say it, and you and spokespeople from every other building, but the Europeans joined you, and they went ahead and did it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that?
Well, of course, as you mentioned, but let me just reiterate, since you gave me the opportunity, the United States deplores and does not recognize yesterday's so-called separatist elections in eastern Ukraine, nor do we recognize any of the leaders chosen in this illegal vote. We also welcome statements from the European Union, United Nations, France, Germany, and others rejecting these illegal and illegitimate actions. If Russia were to recognize the so-called elections, it would only serve to isolate it further. In terms of what it will mean for separatists, obviously we have a range of tools. I don't have any prediction on that in terms of what it will mean.
Well, forget about the people themselves and whether they might be subject to any additional sanctions or any additional sanctions, but what does this mean in terms of U.S. policy toward the east of Ukraine?
Well, we don't recognize the leaders. It's part of Ukraine, part of the Ukrainian government.
Can I just ask, you said that if Russia were to recognize the so-called elections, it would only isolate the country even further. But, I mean, Russia's actually said it respects the outcome of the poll and said that those people who have been elected in these elections have a mandate to resolve the issues to try and reestablish normal life. So I guess what Moscow's trying to say is that in further negotiations with Kiev to resolve this political crisis, those people who've been elected in these elections should have a seat at the table. Would you object to these elected officials having a role in further negotiations to resolve the political crisis?
Well,
in
as
Ukraine?
You know, there have been times in the past where Ukrainian authorities have invited in separatists to discussions and conversations. Obviously, now they're implementing the Minsk agreement, so it's sort of a different point in time, but that's a decision for the Ukrainian leadership to make.
Joe's going to make an interesting point. I mean, you can say so-called elections, but people did actually vote. It may not have met your standards, but people did vote. Do you believe that these people that they did elect have any legitimacy to represent people from that part of the country?
We don't, no.
So who should be representing the East, Donetsk and Luhansk?
Well,
when you go to the table to talk about the things that the Poroshenko government says that it wants to do in terms of giving greater autonomy, who should represent the people of the East? I mean, are these people who were elected disqualified from representing them simply because you don't?
There's a bunch of issues here. Obviously, we continue to believe that any elections need to be done through the central Ukrainian government and implemented in that way. And there are upcoming elections in December, as you know. But the second piece of it is there's obviously an agreement that is being implemented right now, the Minsk agreement.
Or not being implemented.
Parts of it are being implemented. More needs to be done. There's no question about that. But in the past, the Ukrainian government are actually the ones who have invited separatists in. It's not that they haven't in the past. Whether or not that's appropriate or there's a place, that's a decision for them to make.
Okay, but you don't believe, the administration does not necessarily believe that the people who were elected in this so-called election are disqualified from representing the people of that region.
We don't recognize their legitimacy as being elected. So there's upcoming elections in December.
Okay.
We'll rely
on
that.
So if these people are re-elected in December or are elected in the first place in December, I mean, simply being Mr. X, who got more votes than Mr. Y did in this election that you don't recognize, doesn't disqualify you from representing the people of that region, does it?
Well, obviously there are a range of individuals who may be guilty of other things who are involved in these elections, Matt. So we'll see what happens in December.
The Ukrainian government in Kiev held its early parlamentary elections October 26th. Moscow has recognized the results of both votes and emphasized that the refusal to recognize either runs counter to the Minsk agreements and would serve to undermine efforts to find peace in the region. Mahdi Darius Nazemroya is a journalist and political analyst based in Ottawa. He addressed the U.S. and EU claims that the elections in the East violate the Minsk agreements.
Well, according to the understanding that was reached in the capital of Belarus, Minsk, through the September Minsk protocols that were signed between both sides, both warring factions in Ukraine, it was understood that the leadership in Luhansk and Donetsk would be recognized. The government in Kiev under President Poroshenko has committed itself to negotiate with the so-called rebel leaders in East Ukraine. These are the representatives of the Luhansk People's Republic and the Donetsk People's Republic. So to negotiate with the representatives of this place, I think it would be contradictory to say that we don't want you to elect your representatives. Who are they going to negotiate with? Do they want people that have just designated themselves as negotiators, or would they rather negotiate with people that have popular support? I mean, when you're talking about negotiations, you want people that are supported on the ground by the population there. And I think this would be self-defeating not to recognize the elections in East Ukraine. You need to talk to the popular authorities there if you want to negotiate. So all this discussion, all these noises coming out of Brussels, coming out of Kiev, and coming out of Washington, D.C., I think that they're going to basically obstruct any peaceful settlement in East Ukraine. I think the Russian Federation's government's doing the right thing. It's doing the logical thing that Kiev should be doing as well, is recognizing the people that are being chosen on the ground in Donetsk and Luhansk. I think if you want to have real negotiations, genuine, authentic negotiations, you need to recognize whoever has popular support on the ground there. If you talk to representatives that don't have the support of the people in East Ukraine, do you think the people in East Ukraine are going to put a stamp of approval or agree to any negotiation settlement that comes out of it?
Richard Becker of the Answer Coalition says the U.S. is interested in Ukraine only for its geopolitical value in its moves against Russia, and that its concerns have nothing to do with democracy. He spoke with Press TV Monday.
Well, today we see the very hypocritical, cynical remarks coming from Washington and from the capitals of Western Europe, denouncing an election in Luhansk and Donetsk in the eastern part of Ukraine. And what makes it particularly hypocritical is that the United States government has sponsored the breaking up of many countries over the years. It separated Panama from Colombia in order to build the Panama Canal a century ago. It created South Korea. It created South Vietnam, which no longer exists. More recently, it created the South Sudan, splitting it away from Sudan. It created, of course, the State of Israel in what is really Palestine. And so, you know, we know that it's not some moral imperative that is causing the U.S. government to denounce this. This is purely based on what they view as the interest, their interests, which are really the interests of empire. They have been trying to capture Ukraine, to bring Ukraine as a whole, including its industrial base in the east, into their orbit, into the orbit of Washington and into NATO. And of course, many of the people in the Ukraine, particularly in the eastern part, but not exclusively there, are resistant of this agenda and resisting the government, an austerity government that's come to power in Kiev through the illegal overthrow of the former government. So when we take all those factors into account, we really must dismiss the U.S. complaints, the U.S. claims, the U.S. and NATO denunciation of the election. This is part of the right of self-determination of the people of Ukraine, and neither the U.S. nor NATO have any right to interfere.
It ain't over yet. That's the message from the supporters and families of the missing student teachers in the Mexican state of Guerrero, with an announcement by the largest public universities in Mexico City that they plan to hold several actions starting Wednesday to demand that the national government find the 43 missing students of Ayotzinapa. Undergraduates of the National Autonomous University of Mexico, the National Polytechnic Institute, the Metropolitan Autonomous University, and the Autonomous University of Mexico City called on all Mexicans to participate in a strike for 72 hours beginning Wednesday to pressure the government to provide more information on their missing schoolmates. The strike will be accompanied by a Wednesday march set to start outside the Pines presidential residence and end in Zocalo Square. For more on those called the missing ones, we have this report from imprisoned journalist and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Los desaparecidos, the missing ones. In Mexico, fires are burning. I mean this metaphorically and literally. For thousands of youth feel the heated indignation against their corrupt government, as shown by their October 13th protests and the firing of government buildings in Chilpancingo, Guerrero State, Mexico. Why did they set the buildings ablaze? They were marking the deadline when government officials were told to return some 43 students who were arrested and taken away by corrupt cops. In September, the 26th and 27th, local police in Iguala, Guerrero, opened fire on three busloads of students from a rural teacher training school in Ayotzinapa. Six people, three students and three passersby, were killed, and 25 people were wounded. The 43 students were hustled into police vehicles and haven't been seen since. Every day since then, protests, marches, and highway blockades have rocked the city, demanding the safe return of the 43 students. The protests against brutal terrorist police and government corruption has only gotten hotter, as events of October 13th have shown us. On October 22nd, hundreds of thousands of people have demonstrated for the students' return all over Mexico and around the world. These students came from rural districts across Mexico, where the children of poor campesinos could get good educations and become teachers. But Mexico, as in the U.S., is under the spell of neoliberalism, which seeks to abolish the schools, which date from the 1930s. Why? Because these schools challenge the hegemony of neoliberalism by teaching kids to think critically and question the ways of the world. The neoliberal government responded to protests with police massacres, and now the disappearance of dozens of students. But protests continue, more militant than ever. It is interesting and telling that when Islamists snatched and kidnapped hundreds of girls in Nigeria, the world went wild. When corrupt, brutal cops massacred students and then kidnapped 43 students and refused to tell their whereabouts, the neoliberal corporate press goes dark. In Mexico, the struggle and the demand for the students' safe return continues. La lucha sigue. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Tuesday, we'll see midterm elections in the U.S., with the entire House of Representatives, about a third of the Senate, and governorships and state legislatures up for grabs. But are the elections really a meaningful measure of public opinion regarding government policy at the federal or state level? Robert McChesney is a University of Illinois professor and co-author of Dollarocracy, He discussed the roles played by media, voter suppression, and money in the upcoming midterm elections in an interview with the Latin American news agency Telesur.
Midterm elections in the United States are very interesting because they can be very important. They select the House, the entire House of Representatives. Most governor's races or key governor's races, which are four-year terms, take place in the mid-years, and a third of the Senate goes up for election. So the outcome of these midterm elections are crucial. But what's striking about midterm elections, and what's almost never talked about in the mainstream press in the United States, is the voter participation rate plummets between presidential years and midterms. So in 2008 or 2012, between 52 and 56% or 58% of Americans over 18 vote. You know, over slightly over half. Now, again, in most European or in Ecuador or Venezuela, that sort of turnout would be considered a scandal, and the election would be considered probably fraudulent. But in America, we hold parades when it gets that high. In off-year elections, it goes down depending on the state, but nationally it goes down in the 40% range. Some states, it's in the low 30s. So less than a third of the eligible voters are voting. And the people who drop out from voting are disproportionately people of color, poor people, young people. They just stop voting. And it's older, richer, whiter people who are the voting base, and not even a high percentage of them necessarily. So our elections in these mid-years are held up as some barometer of the will of the people. They're nothing of the kind. They're a barometer of who actually votes, which is a completely different group than the will of the people of the country. And so it's sort of, if you were, you think Americans were absolutely schizophrenic, if you don't understand that. How could suddenly in 2008, everyone's voting Democrat? 2010, they switch over to vote for these ultra-right-wing Republicans. 2012, they're back voting Democrat. 2014, they're back voting for Republicans. It doesn't happen like that. They're voting for the same people each time. It's just that Democrats stop voting in the midterms because a lot of their votes come from poor people, young people. And so that's the way to begin. So this is no referendum on the attitudes or opinions of the American people whatsoever. The conservative governors who win in these northern states can't win in presidential years if over half the voters in their state were voting. They only win these low turnout years. And this also explains why, in really an obscene manner, there's such a concerted effort to suppress the vote in America today. Something that, I mean, obscene is the only word for it. There's literally no defense for it. But there's a strong effort now to require people to show IDs, to have all sorts of proof of identification in order to vote. And they know that for people who don't have driver's licenses, and a lot of people in inner cities have no reason to have driver's licenses, or young people, that then they won't be able to vote. And they know that disproportionately these people aren't going to vote for their candidates. So they proceed with this opportunistic ruse despite its obscenity and its anti-democratic basis. And that's the truth of American politics, this ugly undercurrent. Our electoral system represents the interests of the few, not the many. And those who benefit by it want to make sure they keep it that way. They want to make elections a gated community.
Mr. Secretary General, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me to welcome you all here in Vienna to the second United Nations Conference on Landlocked Developing Countries.
That was Sebastian Kurz, the president of the second United Nations Conference on Landlocked Developing Countries, which opened Monday in Vienna.
There's one thing I personally share with 50% of people living in landlocked developing countries. We are all under the age of 30 years. But while Austrians of my generation can look at a bright future full of opportunities, most of the young people in landlocked developing countries don't have the chance to follow their aspiration in life.
Participants from governments of landlocked countries, transit developing countries, donor countries, UN and other international organizations, and the private sector came together to shape the new development agenda for the landlocked developing countries over the next decade. Jocelyn Sambera reports from the United Nations.
Lack of roads and means of transportation, shipping costs, delays at border crossings, and bottlenecks in neighboring countries' ports are some of the challenges landlocked countries have to face. There are globally 32 landlocked developing countries, or LDCs. 16 of them are in Africa, 10 are in Asia, 4 in Europe, and 2 in Latin America, with a combined population of 440 million people. Gayan Chandra is the United Nations LDC High Representative.
When you look at the Human Development Index of all these countries, they are almost at the lowest level of the Human Development Index. So through this conference, we are really trying to see how we can make use of the cooperation, collaboration, and international support with a very strong national leadership in all these countries. The areas that they are really looking at is transit, trade, transportation, structural transformation of their economy, and the impacts of the global challenges on them, and then the international support measures and means of implementation.
Participants of the conference are also reviewing a program of action that was adopted in Almaty, Kazakhstan, 11 years ago. The UN Secretary General urged delegates to be bold and forward-looking as they shape a new agenda for the next decade. Ban Ki-moon called for an even more ambitious, comprehensive, and results-oriented plan.
We want to turn landlocked countries into land-linked countries, integrated with a global economy in a way that connects both markets and people. The issues we are discussing here are central to the global dialogue of the United Nations is now leading on a bold new framework for sustainable development.
The LDCs have witnessed an increase in economic growth and foreign direct investment and exports have increased, the UN says. The conference hopes to build stronger partnerships between these landlocked countries and their neighbors. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe said that the key to meeting the challenges of geography facing his country and other landlocked nations is better transportation and communications infrastructure, as well as regional political integration.
It gives me great pleasure to join you in this round table devoted to the theme of regional integration and transport cooperation. The subject of our exchanges this morning is of cardinal interest to all landlocked developing countries. The success or failure of regional integration and transit cooperation initiatives has a huge bearing on overcoming the challenges of being landlocked. Due to its central location at the heart of the Southern African region, Zimbabwe is both a landlocked and transit country, but it is not unique in this respect, since many other landlocked countries are also transit countries. This special geographic circumstance, however, heightens our country's consciousness of the indispensability of regional integration and cooperation for survival and progress. The duality of our position as landlocked and transit countries compels us to take into account national and regional dimensions as we plan and develop our transport, infrastructure, and other ancillary services related to transit routes. Mr. Chairman, I'm pleased to note that regional integration in its many forms has been widely accepted and embraced throughout the world. What will be important as the integration processes deepen, especially among developing countries, is to ensure that specific challenges of landlocked and transit countries receive particular attention in the interest of achieving balanced development throughout the region. Mr. Chairman, as you're aware, my country currently has the privilege of chairing the 15-member Southern African Development Community, SADC. SADC has generally enjoyed peace and stability, thereby providing an environment that is conducive to fostering cooperation among its members. To concretize our cooperation in SADC, we have adopted several programs and protocols. For instance, the SADC Regional Infrastructure Development Master Plan, the RIDMP, adopted at the 32nd Ordinary Summit of Heads of State and Government held in August 2012 in Maputo, Mozambique, aims at improving the transport, energy, and communication connectivity in the region, which is important in addressing the challenges faced by landlocked developing countries. The RIDMP is a 15-year program which is divided into phases of 5 years, 5 years each. Its six identified priority sectors are energy, transport corridors, ICT, meteorology, water, and tourism. The first phase of the master plan should be implemented from 2012 to 2017, with an initial investment target of around $65 billion. Mr. Chairman, at their 34th summit, which my country had the honor of hosting in Victoria Falls from the 17th to the 18th of August this year, the SADC leaders adopted a declaration on infrastructure development, thus underlining their preoccupation with improving connectivity and ease of movement within the region. Mr. Chairman, with specific regard to transport, we are continuously reviewing the regulatory policies that countries apply to transit transport within the Southern African region. These reviews endeavor to eliminate inefficiencies and non-physical barriers to cross-border transport and connectivity. The Common Market for Eastern and Southern Africa, COMESA, the East African Community, EAC, and SADC are designing and implementing various instruments to promote transport cooperation in the region. The instruments include, but are not limited to, the following. One, coordinated axle load limits. Two, carrier license and transit plates. Three, simplified and harmonized transit charges. Four, regional customs bonds. Five, establishment of one-stop border posts. Six, harmonized and simplified customs documentation procedures and nomenclatures. And seven, surveillance and monitoring mechanisms to observe and reduce rent seeking and other unacceptable practices along transit routes. Zimbabwe is also a member of the Common Market for Eastern and Southern Africa, COMESA. Within COMESA, we have a number of initiatives aimed at improving efficiencies in border facilitation measures and transit procedures. The Common Market has adopted a protocol for transit trade and transit facilities, boosting the trade competitiveness of landlocked developing countries and their integration into global trade and value chains. Mr. Chairman, in spite of the many challenges and constraints we face, I am convinced that the ongoing activities will yield the desired results.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.